Well, this is Christmas time, and that means we're all spending a little bit more time with our family and at home. And so I'm doing that these last 2 weeks of the year. And thank you for granting me that opportunity. I will not leave you as orphans, though. We have something for you. And that is a talk that I gave on one of the cruises called Primer on Clear Thinking. So here we go with part two of Primer on Clear Thinking. I ended last time kind of on a with leaving you hanging a bit, and I offered you a little syllogism, and here's the syllogism: everything God made is good, seems to be true. Hell is not good, and it seems to be true after a fashion. Well, then what follows from that is that God did not make hell, and that's a problem. And so I was giving this really as an example of equivocation. We went on some other examples, but I never came back to this. And so I'm just going to point out, in case you weren't sure, what is the word in that argument that is equivocal, that is being used in a different sense in the different sentences of the argument? Good, the word good. So when I say everything God made is good, I mean everything God made is morally good, okay? But then when I say hell is not good, am I talking about morally good? No, I'm talking about what? Subjectively good. No, it's not fun. That's right. Nobody wants to go there. This is not going to be a happy day, all right? And so because my terms are used, the same word is used differently in different parts of the argument, this upends the argument. So here I'm going to offer you another example of an equivocal argument, and I hear this one on occasion because it has to do with a political notion. And I just want you to tell me what's wrong with it. This has to do with school vouchers. And I heard this on a LA talk show with the... The talk show has been around for a long time. He's a very smart guy. He's an attorney. But this is the way he argued. He said, with regards to vouchers, that's where you take public money and people can use it. If they don't want to go to a public school, they can go to a private institution and use that. And here's what he said: public money for public education. Public money for public education. I heard it with my own ears. And probably if we weren't talking about this, like there's something wrong with that and maybe it's an equivocation, I bet you most of you would not have noticed anything amiss with that. And you might have thought to yourself, well, it is public money, so we should use it for public education. Okay? But there's an equivocation in there. That is, that there's a term that is being used with a little different definition in each part of the phrase, and therefore it is not a sound argument. Now, what would that term be? Public, yes. He, what in the first, public funds, what does public funds mean? The taxes. Where do taxes come from? From the people, right? Okay. Now, what does public mean when he says public education in the second sentence? What does public mean? Government. Now, it's not government funds because the government doesn't make any money. Well, I guess they have made some money. But you know what I'm talking about. You're right. The first means the money that the government holds in trust that really is the money of the people. It's that sense of public. But then he means in the second one that we ought to use that for government education. Now, how do we fix it so we can get rid of the equivocation? Well, then we use in the second sentence the same definition as the first sentence. Use the word public in the same way. So let's just use the synonym. How about money from the people? That would be taxes, right? Public funds. Money from the people should go to the education of the people. Oh, now that changes things, doesn't it? Does that sound right, by the way? That is the intuition that this talk show host is playing on. you know, public funds for public education. But it turns out the terms are equivocal, and once you fix it, then the intuition is a sound one. If people are given their own money, then that money should be used for their own education. But it doesn't necessarily have to be a government institution. And when you take away the equivocation, it turns out to be a good slogan in favor of vouchers. Not against vouchers. Okay, so there's an example of equivocation. This has come up to me at different times, and I mentioned this once before. Jesus is God. God is a Trinity. Therefore, Jesus is a Trinity. And, Jesus is God, and God is a Trinity, and therefore, Jesus is a Trinity. It seems to follow. The problem there is there is an equivocation in there. And it wasn't exactly, it seems to follow when you look at it, but you know it's wrong. And the problem is not that the premises aren't factual. The problem is in the terms. And what is the word that is the problem in that particular syllogism? Yes. Pardon me?
Yes.
Is. So when President Clinton says, it all depends what is, right? Remember that way back when? Well, if he was speaking philosophically, he'd have a point. Because there are actually five different ways the word is used. And sometimes it can make a big difference. There's the is of identity. I'm not going into all five things, but I just want to solve this problem for you. There is the is of identity. So Greg Kokel is the president of Stand to Reason. In the is of identity, everything that is true about the first is equally true about the second. And if you could find something different in Greg Kokel than the president of Stand to Reason, well, then you'd know that I'm not identical to the president of Stand to Reason, all right? If when you're talking about these is of identity, there's not actually two things. There's just one thing described in different ways. And incidentally, this is the discussion about whether the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob and Jesus of Nazareth is the same God of Muhammad. That's the discussion, essentially, okay? And my answer is no. I'm not going to go into details, but no, he's not. But there's also the is of essential predication. So you could say Greg Kokel is a human being. Now, that's a different use of the word is, okay? So when we say God, when we say Jesus is God, do we mean that everything that is true about Jesus is true about God? Now, the right answer is no. Some of you are thinking, I'm not sure. And I can see I get confused on this a little bit. No, Jesus is not God in that way because Jesus had a physical body. Does the Father have a physical body? No. No, we're using the word is in terms of essential predication. That is, all the essential qualities of divinity are present in the person of Jesus, even though Jesus is not identical, the exact same thing as God. Okay, and I had Jehovah's Witness that gave me a hard time on an argument like this, and I got caught sideways because of the equivocation in the nature of the argument. Now, it took me a few weeks, and I got it unwound, and we took care of it, but I talked about it all in the show, but it was this particular kind of thing. And so there's another example where the terms that are not clear can get you into trouble. Now, I mentioned a couple of different, we mentioned one way that arguments can be laid out. We talked about Socrates is a man. All men are mortal. Socrates is a man, and therefore Socrates is mortal. That is a particular kind of form of an argument, okay? And we actually use that form in different aspects of Christianity. For example, the moral logic of the pro-life view can be stated in a formal way like that. And actually, it's good that you get this, because if we're going to argue in favor of the pro-life view, we want to have a very crisp and clean argument in view. And the way our argument goes, it's like this. This is the moral logic of the pro-life view. It is wrong to take the life of an innocent human being. Okay? Now, you might add without proper justification, because we all know there's some exceptional circumstances, whatever, collateral damage and wars and things like that. But we're just kind of leaving those special items aside for the moment. As a general statement, it is wrong to take the life of an innocent human being. Second premise, abortion takes the life of an innocent human being. Therefore, what? Abortion is wrong. Now, is that a valid argument? And what I mean by that is, does the conclusion follow from the premises? Yeah, it does. It is valid. Nobody can fault the argument for its validity. So if you're going to push back against that conclusion, you have to push back against what? The premises, one or the other. Okay. Now, what is the premise that most people will push back against? Do you think they're going to take exception with the premise that it's wrong to take a life of an innocent human being? No, they're not going to do that. Okay. They're going to push back against the second one, that the human being, that the unborn is an example of an innocent human being. But if you follow our materialist stand of reason, making abortion unthinkable, the art of pro-life persuasion, we spend some time to show very persuasively, without making any religious argument at all, that scientifically and philosophically, very clear that the, actually just simply scientifically at this point, that the unborn is a human being. Whatever's in there is alive. If it wasn't alive, it wouldn't be growing. But it's growing. That's the problem. So it's alive. It ain't mom. How do we know it ain't mom? CSI. DNA, right? It's got a different DNA fingerprint. Something alive. Mom's involved. It's inside there. But it's not mom. But what? So it's some different living thing. What kind of living thing is it? DNA also. It's got a signature that's human. What's going on? The thing in there is a growing, separate, individual human being. Now, one would think you don't have to argue for that because I think it's pretty straightforward. Human beings reproduce after their own kind. You get pregnant, you know, you're not wondering, gee, what's it going to be this time? You have a baby boy human being. Oh, my gosh, five in a row. What are the chances? You know, no, this is the way things work. But see, to be careful, because of the way the dialogue is in culture now, we got to be careful and talk about this. Okay, one moment. So there's a human being inside there. So it turns out abortion does take the life of an innocent human being. This is irrefutable. So they don't want to accept the conclusion. So now what do they have to push back on? They have to push back? No, okay, let's stick with our syllogism. No, not when life begins, because we've already established that. They push back on the first premise. Remember, look at this is very simple. You have two premises that lead to a conclusion. It's wrong to take the life of an innocent human being. Abortion takes the life of an innocent human being, therefore abortion is wrong. Okay? Now, if the first two statements are true and the argument is valid, that means the conclusion is the argument sound and the conclusion follows, and you can't beat that. It is necessarily the case that abortion is wrong. So the only way to defeat this is to defeat one of the factual statements. And they go for the second one, and then we show them that that can't be done. And so they go for the first one. And they say, no, actually, it's not wrong to take the life of an innocent human being. It is wrong to take the life of an innocent human person. Now they change the terms. It's okay to kill human beings as long as they're not persons. So now we have some human beings are not human persons. And my question at this point, and I'll just give you a little tactical tip here. My question at this point is to always ask this question when that comes up. What's the difference? That is, what is the difference between a human being and a human person? Or human being, non-person, human being, person. Because what they've done is they've just divided humanity into two groups. One group, human non-persons. You're really human beings, but you get no protection and you can be killed with impunity, sometimes even with the help of the state. This other group, you are human persons and you're fully and completely protected, and if anybody kills you, the full force of the law comes down on you. Now, if that's the way you're setting up the world, you better be really clear on where that line is. Okay, and then this becomes another discussion. Is that distinction between human being, person, and human being, non-person, a legitimate distinction? And some of you know this is where the SLED test comes in. I'm not going to go into that, but I just want you to see now how we are able to take argumentation and put it to work for us. And I will tell you something, though. I have talked to many people who are pro-life who cannot begin to articulate crisply and cleanly the logic of the pro-life view, like I've just done, in a very simple way for you. Now, one thing more and more nowadays, I just need to say this because I've had some conversations with some of the conferees here about this. It is very, very sad that more and more nowadays you can make your case completely. They will say, yes, this is a living human being, even a human person, if you will, but it's still okay to take their life. They will not acknowledge that it's wrong to take the life of an innocent human being in the case of abortion. They will not allow acknowledge that it's wrong to take the life of an innocent human person in the case of abortion. It's legal. We're going to do it. We don't care. And some have asked me, well, what do you do at that point? And my response is, there's nothing you can do. What is the only response that society has to people who know what is right and refuse to do it on a weighty moral issue? Lock them up. But in this particular case, you can't lock them up because the law's on their side. So there's not much you can do. There's no magic bullet here. But I'll tell you what, knowing the moral logic of the pro-life view and being able to work through it in the way that we train people to do it in making abortion unthinkable, the art of pro-life persuasion, has been very effective to change a lot of lives. So arguments do work. People's minds are changed on this. I know there's some involved with the crisis pregnancy centers here that use that training material couple two or three times a year, and it's really effective for their team. Okay, now, there are other ways for these kind of arguments to be stated. I mentioned this standard syllogistic form. There's another way we use the same form. It's called the Kalam cosmological argument. A lot of people are familiar with that because it's been popularized by philosopher William Lane Craig. And when he gives an argument, he lays it out just so. It's really nice and tight. And the argument goes this way. All things that come into being have a cause. The universe came into being. Therefore, the universe had a cause. All things that come into being have a cause. The universe came into being. Therefore, the universe had a cause. By the way, is that valid?
Yes.
Yeah, it seems to follow. Yeah, you can just see it. Now, the question is, are the premises true? Well, our universal experience is that the first premise is true, right? Everything we know about science is that the second thing is true. Second premise is true, too. So it seems like this is a sound argument. Now, I've seen lots of ways people try to get out from underneath this, but I think it's really solid. It's one of the strongest arguments in my view. For the existence of God, and you can express it in lots of different ways. And my simple way of putting it is the Big Bang. What needs a big banger? Okay, straightforward common sense notion. And so you can put it in different ways, but that's if you're going to put it tight. That's the way Bill Craig lays it out. But there are other forms of argument. And the form could be more of an if-then kind of thing. If this is true, then this is going to be true. Just simply, for example, we heard this, I think, in one of the films that somebody ran. I think it was John. It was a clip. If there is evil in the world, then there is no God. There is evil in the world, therefore, there is no God. That was the German teacher, and then he had the student that was talking to him, and he tried to... He's making the case that evil itself doesn't exist. It doesn't have ontological status. It's a privation of something else. Really tripped up his professor. But this is the way people are going to argue. It's an if-then kind of thing. If this is true, then this will be true. And this is true, therefore, this other thing is true. It has a name. It's called modus ponens. Did I get that right? Modus ponens? Yeah, professor. You don't have to remember all the fancy names, but it gets played out in different ways. There's an example of it, how it gets played out. And so if that's going to be their argument and that is a valid example of modus ponens, then what we have to do is we have to deal with the premises. Our job then is to show that one of two things, either there is no evil in the world or that if there is evil, that doesn't mean there's no God. And of course, we all know there's evil in the world, right? So now we know where our task lies if we're going to parry this particular kind of challenge. And that's where we spend our time. And in fact, this is the way this problem has been solved. It can be offered in a deductive form as well, not just in this if-then kind of form. And the basic result, how Christians have worked through this, is that it's simply not the case, and this can be demonstrated, that if there was a God, a good, powerful God in the world, that he would get rid of all evil. That is a false premise, and it can be demonstrated. And this is, frankly, why many philosophers won't argue this way anymore, because they can't get away with it. And people like Alvin Plantinga and other people have shown that, gee, you know, can you imagine some circumstance in which God might have a good reason to allow some evil for some time? And if you can imagine that it's possible that God could allow evil for some good reason, maybe he doesn't even tell us what that reason is, But it seems like there might be a good reason, and most of us who are parents can understand there's some parallels even in parenting. Well, then God is off the hook on this one. It is not the case that if there is a God, there would be no evil in the world. That's a false premise, and so it helps us to deal with that problem. But there's a variation of that argument called modus tollens, and it's a very, very powerful way, I think, in arguing in favor of God. And it goes like this. Sounds almost the same, but it's just kind of the flip side. If there is no God, there is no objective morality. I just want you to think about it for a moment. How could there be morality if there's no God? In fact, that's how we sometimes just put it. We'll kind of make reference to this whole argument by saying, well, look at it. If God doesn't exist, then how come there's morality? All right? And this is the shorthand way of offering this argument. If there's no God, then there's no objective morality, but there is objective morality. Therefore, there must be a God. Now, is that a valid argument? That is, does the conclusion follow from the premises if the premises are true? Let me just say it again, because this one's a little trickier to get in your mind. If there is no God, then there is no objective morality. But there is objective morality, therefore there must be a God. Now, that's the moral argument for the existence of God. And I think it is a fabulous argument, personally. I make this argument all the time. C.S. Lewis made it at the beginning of Mere Christianity. But of course, how do we know there's objective morality? I'm just going to give you a shortcut, because there's a problem of evil. The problem of evil requires there to be objective morality. Think about the way people complain about evil. How could God exist if there is all this evil in the world? The way they put it is an acknowledgement that there is evil in the world that goes beyond mere individual preference. They're not saying, how could there be a God in the world because things happen that are different from what my own preferences happen to be. That would be the, like, I can't believe a God because of Brussels sprouts, you know. What's wrong with Brussels sprouts? Man, you ever taste those things? They're disgusting. I can't believe in a God who would make a world that would include something so distasteful to me. Well, it's a trivial kind of objection. We realize it, but this is what the objection to God's existence amounts to, coming from a relativist. If morality is relative and it's just up to me and you have your morality, and then all the objection according to the existence of God amounts to, in the problem of evil, is that God allows things to happen that I don't like. So he must not exist. I mean, this is silly. In order to raise the problem of evil, there has got to be objective evil in the world. And this you could take to the bank. It's one of the most effective things that I've ever used in my argumentation in favor of God. Is evil real? Yes, it's real. Everybody's complaining about it. Is it one thing everybody knows for sure? Something's wrong with the world. And the other thing is close to it. Something's wrong with us. And actually, it turns out the thing that's wrong with the world is what's wrong with us. Going back to the story of reality. Man disobeyed God. Just like when kids disobey, they break things. Man broke man himself, and he broke the world too. So we have an explanation for why the world is the way it is. And I'm not going to go into now, like, how do we deal with the problem of evil? What I'm trying to show you is that the fact that there is a problem of evil establishes the truth of objective morality, okay? And once you have the truth of objective morality, you've got the most important part of your argument here, the moral argument for God. There is morality. Because the other part of it is, if there is no God, there wouldn't be any of that stuff. And that means now it's the atheist's job to show how you can get objective morality. I'm using my terms carefully here. How you can get objective morality with no God. There's only one way I've heard of, and I'll tell you about that in a moment. And I have actually only heard one person ever raise it. But, and this just happened about a week ago, and it didn't last long because I had some responses for him, you know, this particular way. Virtually every single time people raise the problem of evil, they are talking about real evil in the world. And when you say, well, and how could there be a God? How could there be evil if there is no God? How could there be wrong morality if there is no God? They say, well, evolution. Well, evolution, if it can do anything, can only do something inside of people. And when evolution does whatever it does inside of you to create your beliefs about morality, is that objective morality or subjective morality? It's subjective morality. Even if it can do what they claim it can do, and I don't think they can. I don't think it can do what they claim it to do, create this belief system that helps us to get our genes in the next generation or whatever. Even if that were true, then the best that evolution can give us, or the social contract for that matter, is just simply relativistic morality. But relativistic morality is not enough to ground the problem of evil. If you got relativistic morality, oh, fine. Well, you're welcome to your evolution and your relativism, but you're not welcome to the problem of evil, because they don't go together. It's one or the other if you're going to be intellectually honest. Now, the only way that I've heard that people have suggested there could be morality without God is by asserting that morality is simply kind of a platonic form. It just kind of sits out there, and there's no God attached to it. So you have moral goods like justice and goodness and whatever, kindness. These can be platonic forms. Okay, well, I guess that's plausible. That's possible. But is it plausible? Does it really explain what it needs to explain? Because how do you get commands out of platonic ideals? How do you get from the ideal of justice, say, the obligation that we ought to be just? And there'll be hell to pay if we don't, you know, something like that. No. Morality makes sense when there's an obligation towards a person who is in a proper position to be the one we are obliged to. Now, I've told the story a lot. I'll tell it really quickly. My daughter, Annabeth, 3 or 4 years ago, asked me, why do we believe in God? You know, she had gotten the what, but not the why. And I was thinking, and I don't know if I've even said this here so far, but I might have, but I say it a lot. I was thinking, and finally it just came out, well, God is the best explanation for the way things are. Have I said that yet? I did. On the radio, okay. But this you can take to the bank. I realized that I'm trying to sum this up for my 8-year-old at the time. I ended up saying something that really captured the way that I do my apologetics. The reason we believe in the resurrection is because the resurrection is the best explanation of the available evidence. The reason that we believe in God is because he's the best explanation for the problem of evil, because he's the best explanation for the existence of morality. And on and on and on. He's the best explanation for the existence of the world. And so there are lots of ways that you can tie this in. This shows that Christianity has explanatory power. And really, it's the heart of what Jim does as a detective. What conclusion, given all the facts, as he drew them out today, given all these facts, what is the best explanation for all of these pieces of evidence? And if it all points to one person, then now that's the best explanation. You probably got your guy. And we're doing the same thing here. We're making an argument that amounts to the best explanation for the way that things are. If there is no God, there's no objective morality. There is objective morality. There's a problem of evil. So then God's going to be the best explanation for that. It turns out there's no other explanation that I know of that works. By the way, again, the Platonic ideals too. How is it that those ideals can be translated into obligations, thou shalt and thou shalt not, that apply simply to human beings, not to other creatures? And so, you know, this seems possible, but not plausible. Doesn't make common sense. We got a better answer that makes perfect sense, that fits all the facts. So anyway, there's a couple of ways that those arguments can be formalized, and it's important for you to know about how they can be formalized, because when you do critical thinking, you're going to do this process in reverse to see if somebody else's point of view actually works. So let me give you the basics of critical thinking. If rational thinking involves a reason or a series of reasons given to support a conclusion, critical thinking simply reverses the process, okay? In rational thinking, you start with the reasons and you build towards the conclusion, and you need to have a couple of things in place that are right. You have to have good facts, you have to have good form, and you got to have clear terms. Those are the three critical things. So when you're assessing any argument, you just go in reverse. You look at the point of view that's being promoted. You start there. And then you ask what the reasons are for the point of view that's being advanced. Okay? Simple. Now, there's a little light that might be going on in your mind right about this time if you're a student of the tactics book. Because what are the first two questions that we teach you to ask in tactics? What do you mean by that? How'd you come to that conclusion? Huh. So in other words, you ask them what their view is, and then you ask them how they got to their view. You start at the end of the reasoning process when you're making a case and looking at the conclusion, then you're asking for the reasons that support it. You see, those two first questions are really the first two questions of critical thinking. And then you want to find out, once you get the so-called facts, whether they are facts or not. And you want to make sure that the facts that are given lead to the conclusion or the point of view that's offered. Now, I did mention yesterday what the most common failure of an argument was. And what did I say? It's just an assertion. There's no argument at all. There's no reasons given. People just give their point of view. This happens time and time again. So that's why when you ask of the person who's giving the point of view what their point of view is, and then ask what are the reasons for it, you get a blank stare because they don't have reasons for it. They've never worked it out. But if critical thinking then is just a matter of kind of putting those things together in reverse, you first ask of any challenge, what's the big idea? What's the big idea? Essentially, you're looking for the argument. The big question is, what's the argument? And you start with what's the idea that they're trying to get you to believe. What's the argument? Well, you start with what's the point. Then you ask for the reasons. And here you make a very simple step. You take the reasons and you link the reasons to the conclusion with the word therefore. You take the reasons and you link the reasons to their point of view or their conclusion with the word therefore, and then you take a good look at it. And if you determine that the reasons they've given are true and the form is valid, well, then the argument's going to be sound. But if the argument's wrong, one of three things is going to be wrong. Either their facts aren't good, the form's not good, or their terms are equivocal. And that's what you're going to look for. It massively simplifies the issue. Sometimes I'll just say to a person, let me see if I understand your view. You say this is true and this is true, and therefore, according to this and this, God does not exist. Now, when somebody raises the problem of evil to me, I always ask them for their argument. I want people to spell it out for me because as far as I've been able to see, you cannot develop a valid deductive argument that shows that if there's evil in the world, there can be no God. It's been attempted, but the premises aren't true. Why should you have a valid argument? You don't have a sound one because the premises are in question. So I want people to spell it out. They've heard lots of things. They think this is a foregone conclusion. This is a cakewalk for them. I say, fine. Well, what about the problem of evil, they say? I say, what about it? Well, evil proves there is no God. Really, how? So now I know what the big idea is. What's their big idea? What are they trying to get me to believe? There's no God. Okay, now I want the reasons. How does this work? Well, because there's evil in the world. Okay, well, because there's evil in the world, there is no God. I don't see how that you're missing something, right? So spell it out for me. How is it? And so I'm going to force them to do that. And if they're careful and clever, they'll say, well, if there is a God that is good, he'd want to get rid of evil. And if he was powerful, he'd be able to get rid of evil. Okay. And therefore there'd be no evil. But there is evil. So either he's not good or powerful. Okay. Now they've cleaned it up a bit. But it's that first premise, and I was just mentioning this a moment ago, that's false. Because it is not the case, it turns out, that if God were good, there would be no evil, because we can demonstrate cases where a good God would allow evil under certain circumstances for a period of time to accomplish a greater good. So what it should say is God would get rid of all evil unless he had a good reason to allow it. And that opens up a lot of possibilities. And this is why the wind has gone out of the sails of that argument for the most part. But what I don't want you to miss is I don't want you to miss the big picture here. You ask broadly, what is the argument? And you look more closely at what's the big idea. And then what are the reasons to support that idea? And you take the reasons and you attach it to the idea with the word therefore. And you ask yourself, does that work? And when you just go through those steps, you will be amazed at how often you clearly see this isn't going to work. And here's what I want you to notice. In face of challenges, I'm not panicking. I don't see a new book out by a big shot author, an atheist. And now I'm panicking. Now my faith is going down the drain, or a new speaker, or whatever. What do? I don't panic. I don't run. I don't whine. I just ask the question, what is the what? Argument. And to get to that, I got to get to the big idea and the reasons, and I see if they connect. So when this happens for you next time around, something sounds really compelling, shakes you up a little bit. You want to kind of close your eyes and run. Just take a deep breath, relax. Ask yourself, what's the argument? And you get there by saying, what's the big idea and what are the reasons for it? And you put the word therefore between them and see if it works. Now, sometimes it's not instantaneous. It takes a little time. But I'll give you some examples of some of these things. This is something that Jay Warner referred to earlier today. The amount of changes that there are in the New Testament, why it seems to most people like this is a no-brainer, you can't trust the New Testament. And actually what Bart Ehrman says, just to be more specific, is that there are 1,300 words in the New Testament and there are there's 130,000 words in the New Testament and there are over 400,000 variations. So there are three times as many, or maybe even more than that. It's hard to count them. Variations in the New Testament than there are words in the New Testament. This rhetorically is really powerful. So what is the argument there? What is the argument there? Anyone take a shot at it?
New Testament's not accurate.
Pardon me?
New Testament's not accurate.
Okay, but what would be the whole argument? That would be the big idea. That's you can't trust the New Testament. Okay, that would be the conclusion they come to. When you ask the question, what is the argument? You say, well, what do they want you to believe? It's not reliable. Why? Because there's so many, not contradictions, but variations. Because there's so many variations, you can't trust the New Testament. Okay. Now, here's the question. Does it follow? You don't answer right away because this one's a little bit trickier. Only because it's not as tidy as maybe one could make it. But does it follow that because there are lots of variations, we could never recover the original? Now, it feels that way, but there's a question that needs to be answered before you can actually conclude that. And I'll just tell you what the question is. It depends on the what? The variations. It depends on what the variations actually amount to. Now, Jay Warner did a fabulous job with his cell phone deal, demonstrating exactly how that can play out. And that is how it plays out. Do you know that like 90%, you can divide the variations up into different categories, okay? Do you know the vast majority of the variations turn out to be what? Spelling errors. Now, if our task is to try to recover the original, does a spelling error keep us from recovering the original? No. I mean, think of all the boutique ways of spelling ordinary names nowadays. You know, and I have to ask every time somebody gives me their name, even if it sounds really, really straightforward, how do you spell it? Because there are a lot of unusual spellings now. But see, if you took the name Jesus and can think of four or five different ways to spell it, you know, to refer to the same individual, it doesn't change our ability to recover the original intention of the author, does it? I can't go into a whole thing on textual criticism, but it turns out that 99.5% of all of the variations are inconsequential variations. That is, they have no bearing whatsoever on recovering the original. I mean, so now the picture looks a lot different when you look at the nature of the variations themselves. And it turns out the other 5%, even if we can't figure out what the right one is, it turns out that the most of these don't have any bearing on anything significant. You know, Did Jesus walk 5 miles or 10 miles to this particular town? I mean, that might be a kind of a variation. Well, that's a meaningful difference. And let's just say you have 50-50 with the manuscripts, the 1.5 million pages of manuscripts we have available to us. Mile high stack compared to the 4-foot stack of the average manuscript of antiquity. It doesn't matter. If it's 5 or 10, even if the meaning is different, it has no bearing on anything meaningful. And this is why, you know, Bart Ehrman is barking up the wrong tree with all the books he's writing. Because he makes it sound so bad, but it turns out it isn't the way he characterizes it. What I'd like to do now is I'd like to go through a series of informal fallacies. And an informal fallacy, remember I talked about a argument being kind of like a house? With walls, which are the reasons, and the roof, which is the conclusion, and the walls have to be adequate to hold the roof up. Well, sometimes you can't get to the look at the structure because there's a whole bunch of garbage in the way, and you got to clear the brush, so to speak. So these are called informal fallacies. These are things that distract you from the real thing. Okay. Now there is a word that is used to generally describe these kinds of errors of thinking. And it's a type of error. It's called a red herring. Anybody heard the phrase red herring before? Okay. Did anybody know why they call this particular error a red herring? Phil. Yeah, well, the dogs are on a trail. You know, you drag this dead fish across your trail into the bushes somewhere, and the dogs are going to follow your scent until it hits the dead herring, not the red herring, and then it goes off the trail. So red herrings are anything that take you off the track, the productive track of dealing with the issue. Now, there's a whole host of these things. It's a general term that is referred to anything that drags you off the track, but there are a lot of varieties of these kinds of things. So let's talk about some of the varieties. I'll tell you the number one red herring that is being used today to discourage or address problems that Christians have to deal with, whether they're social issues or theological issues, is to simply attack the person who holds the view they don't like. Now, if you said to me, Jesus is the Savior, and I said, there's no way he could be the Savior. And you say, why not? And I say, because you are really ugly. Now, you see how that's a red herring. Whether a person's ugly or not is a distraction from the claim. You can't determine whether the claim about Jesus is true or not by this thing that's just been tossed into the conversation. But this is the single most frequent way that people deal with important issues today is to call names, all right? And what are the kinds of names they call? Well, Dennis Prager has an acronym for it. It's called SixHerb. And let me see if I can remember. SixHerb is sexist, Islamophobic, homophobic, xenophobic, yeah, racist, and bigoted, or something like that. You know, there they are. He says it real fast because he remembers it from the thing, but that's it. These are all the things that people use to substitute for something substantive. And I want you to write this sentence down, because you could use it sometime, and I'm not going to guarantee it's going to do you any good, but it's a good sentence. And here's the sentence. Ridicule is not a what? Argument. Ridicule is not an argument. Now, you can substitute other things, like name-calling is not an argument. Making me look stupid is not an argument. Laughing at me is not an argument. You're welcome to do that. I'm glad you feel better now, and everybody had a good laugh, but I just wanted to remind you that it's not an argument. And these are the kinds of things that people should have outgrown a long time ago. But it is a virtue in our society to do this kind of thing, it seems. It's done so often. The rate that people of principle are called haters is unbelievable to me, especially when, and I have a series of slides sometimes that I show to demonstrate this, the ones that are claiming the other side is hateful are the ones who are actually expressing the most hate. I have a picture from the front page of an LA Times, and the headline says, gay leaders say demonstrators using hateful tactics. And then they have two pictures there, and there's this picture I showed up on the screen, you know, and there's these guys with, you know, and actually in this case they have like sport coats on and stuff, you know, so like the conservatives, you know, like, and they got their signs up, and then I go, well, wait a minute, that's the gay leaders. Sorry, wrong picture. And then you look at the picture of the protesters. They're four Russian old women in babushkas sitting on a bench. That's the hateful demonstrators, you know. So what ends up happening is the others call Christians the hateful lot, but they have the freedom to do with impunity the most bizarre things and the most unpleasant things, you know, all in the name of acceptance, tolerance, and love. This happens all the time. And so this is where those of you who know about the suicide tactic, this comes in. They're committing practical suicide. They're doing the very thing that they're claiming the other side is guilty of. How about this one? This is Kathleen Dixon, Director of Women's Studies, Bowling Green State University, canceling a class on political correctness. We forbid any course that says we restrict free speech. Well, it really amazes me, because apparently somebody was giving a class that was critical of political correctness and say they restrict free speech. Well, we don't allow classes to say that. Oh, man. What amazes me is Kathleen Dixon, who I presume is the Director of Women's Studies at Bowling Green State, is a fairly intelligent person and lettered appropriately, but still makes a statement like this. And I've seen this time and time and again, that people who are very intelligent, brilliant, educated, make the most fundamental mistakes in thinking when it comes to spiritual things. Okay. So ad hominem is the title for that kind of thing. That's the kind of red herring. That means to the man instead of to the thing. To the man rather than to the issue itself. And boy, this kind of thing happens all the time. It happens all the time. How about this? I'm going to give you a powerful little word to use when dealing with those kinds of situations. When properly used, it has the ability to completely stop a challenger in their tracks and turn the tables and get them thinking. It's a little giant, basically. Puts the ball back in their court, puts you in the driver's seat. And the word in question, or the word that I'm suggesting, is the word so, with a question mark. Okay. Now, here's how you're going to use this. This is great to use with people who do trash talk like this, ad hominem. All right. You acknowledge the legitimacy of their claim. Now, let me ask you something. If they say you're ugly, and you are, let's just say there's a few. In other words, they're right. Does that lead to the conclusion that they are putting forward? No, it has nothing to do. It's a red herring, okay? So it's a way of the form being bad. It doesn't lead to it at all. So what you could do is you could agree that they're right on the point that they're making, but then you can ask them whether the point that they're making is relevant to the issue, and this is the way you do it. You just use the word so. Like, for example, and this can be done with different types of fallacies, but this is the technique that you use. So I was speaking at San Diego State, University of San Diego, UC San Diego, University of California in San Diego. And it was a whole week of lectures by Christians coming at different nights. And so the night that I was coming, it was Wednesday night, I was doing a talk on relativism. So it was the philosophy evening. And that was my presentation. But before that, I went out to dinner with campus leadership, the Christians. And I said, hey, give me some insight on what the skinny is on campus regarding Christians. What do other people think of the Christians? And one guy says, well, they think Christians are dumb. I thought, well, that's good. I'm going to use that to start my talk. And so when I got up on the stage after being introduced, I said, I understand many of you think Christians are dumb. I said, a lot of them are. So? A lot of dumb non-Christians too, right? There's dumb Christians, there's dumb non-Christians. What does that get you? That gets you nothing. You get nowhere with that. What I want to demonstrate for you is that Christianity is not dumb. That's what I said. That was my lead into my topic on relativism. But there's a lot of things that you can use that for. You know, there's another type of challenge that people make towards Christianity. It's called the genetic fallacy. the genetic fallacy. The reason they call it the genetic fallacy is because you are faulting an idea based on where it comes from, its genesis, as it were, its origin. You fault the idea because of where it comes from. Do you ever hear this one in the pro-life movement? People say to you, and you're a fella kind of make the case for the pro-life view, and someone says, "Hey, you're a man." You know, I wonder if nowadays maybe they wouldn't make that particular point anymore, because who knows? But certainly, classically, you're a man. So it's meant to disqualify. Well, abortion's a woman's issue, you know. But you're a man, so what? Did you ever notice that, you know, these are all men that are arguing against abortion? Well, I said, would you ever notice that we're all men that decided on Roe v. Wade in favor of abortion? Now, does the fact that you're a man have anything to do with the legitimacy of your argument regarding killing unborn human beings? No, it's irrelevant. And so you could say, yes, thank you, I am a man. Thank you for noticing. So, what is the relevance? Now, it might be that they'll try to give you some relevance. Now you got something more to work with, okay? But you parry this foolishness by just simply saying, so. Some people say you are a Christian because you were raised in the United States. If you were raised in Iran, you wouldn't be a Christian, you'd be a Muslim. Now, I mean, issues of sovereignty of God aside, do you think that's probably a reasonable thing to say? Yeah, I think so. You know what this tells you about? Does it tell you anything about Christianity? No, it tells you about anthropology. But it's not the topic, anthropology. Christianity is the topic. So what is this? This is a red herring trying to drag you off the path. So you might say, you know what? You're probably right. If I was born in Iran, I'd probably be a Muslim. Right. So? Now it's their turn to explain the relevancy of that observation to the point in question. Because there is no relevancy. It does not matter where the idea came from. That itself cannot disqualify the idea. We watched it on the clip. Was that I don't know if it was Jay Warner's or John Stone Street's, but you saw that long clip of the psychologist who was talking about how we explain through evolutionary means the origin of religious belief. Remember that? Wow, that might be really interesting for anthropologists or psychologists. But it doesn't tell you a single thing about the legitimacy of any religious belief at all, because it doesn't address the religious belief. Listen, you cannot refute an idea by talking about something else. Let me just say that again. It's not my quote. I can't remember where I got it, but it's good. Maybe Lewis said it. You cannot refute an idea by talking about something else. You've got to talk about the thing. And people are constantly trying to talk about something else. Your character, your politics, your gender, your emotional states. Oh, people believe in God because they have a need for a crutch. We saw that quote today from Richard Dawkins. And Jesus is just a crutch. You know what I say to people? Got that right. Jesus is a crutch. Absolutely. Crippled people need crutches, and I'm screwed up. I need help. What do I say next? So? Does the fact that I have a need for Christ demonstrate that Jesus doesn't exist? Or that he isn't the one he claimed to be? Or that God isn't real? Or that Christianity is false? That observation never addresses any of those things, so it can't deal with any of those things. It is a red herring. It's a rabbit trail people are dragging you off on. Christians are hypocrites. Yeah. There's a few. Probably more than a few. Of course, if somebody says I don't go to church because it's full of hypocrites, I always ask them, when was the last time you were in church? Well, I've been there for 30 years. Well, how do you know it's full of hypocrites? And it's, you know, it's another issue, but yeah, so Christianity is about Christ, not about Christians. What we're promoting is Christ, not Christians. So to talk about the hypocrites in the church, I mean, this may be a fair complaint. It may be a libel. I don't know. I actually don't think most Christians are hypocrites, not the ones that I've encountered. They're not always consistent. That's different from hypocrisy. Hypocrisy is being a faker. Christians, they're not fakers. They're just human beings doing the best they can, and sometimes we don't do as we ought, and we acknowledge that. It's not a justification, okay? So there are lots of things that people could say that really are irrelevant, and you could fully acknowledge the truthfulness of what they say because sometimes they're onto something. I mean, you might be ugly. I don't know. But it's not relevant to the issue, so you can ask the question, you know, so you toss that in there and force them to make the connection, okay? Now, again, I'm not going to guarantee that they're going to they're going to say, oh, man, you got me. That was really dumb thinking. Maybe I should think something differently. Because that presumes intellectual integrity, and a lot of people don't have that, all right? But it gets you out of the hole, and it puts the ball back in their court where it belongs. So that's just another way of taking their rationale, their reasons, and asking if the reasons support the conclusion. You know, I'm ugly, therefore my views about religion are wrong. No. You laugh because it's so obvious. How about the complaint that religion causes more bloodshed and wars than any other thing? Okay, now what's the argument there? What would be the argument?
Every war is a religious war.
Who's talking here?
Oh, every war is a religious war.
Well, that's not the argument. He said what he says is religion causes more wars. So let's just stretch it out with the facts, the point, and the conclusion. Okay. Anybody want to take a shot at it? What are they trying to? What's the big idea? Well, that's certainly true in this case. But what is I'm trying to get at, here's our goal. We want to get at the argument. Here's the claim, the charge. There's an argument in there somewhere. They are trying to persuade us of something. So what's the big idea? What are they trying to persuade us of when they say that kind of thing? Religion's bad. Great. Why is religious bad? Why is religion bad? Because religion causes more wars than any other thing and bloodshed, etc. Therefore, religion is bad. Okay, so let me... Hold on a second. I'm kind of all over the place with these notes here. Let's see if that works. Some religious people create wars and kill people. Therefore, all religion is bad. Does that follow?
No.
Some religions teach war and bloodshed, therefore all religions are false. Well, that doesn't follow. Some religious folk kill other people, therefore God doesn't exist. No, that doesn't follow either. In other words, when you try to take the claim that they're making about religion and try to build it into the conclusion that they get, you spell it out, and it clearly doesn't follow. It does not work. But there's another problem with that particular claim, and that one is, not only is it not valid, it isn't factually accurate. It is not the case that religion causes more war and bloodshed than any other kind of thing. In fact, it's secularism that does that, not religion. So there, their facts are wrong. Okay, and there's a whole lot more that could be said about that, but I just want to use that as an example. What's another kind of a? I talked about genetic fallacy. Yeah, I did. I talked about that. I want to give you some more examples of that. So I want to read something to you that C.S. Lewis wrote. It's really the best example, the best thing I could read dealing with genetic fallacy. It's so good. I'll just let him tell you about it. If I say that all, I'm sorry. Suppose I think, after doing my accounts, that I have a large balance in the bank. And suppose you want to find out whether this belief of mine is wishful thinking. You can never come to any conclusion by examining my psychological condition. Your only chance of finding out is to sit down and work through the sum yourself. Now, when you've checked out my figures, then and then only will you know whether I have that particular balance or not. And if you find my arithmetic wrong, then it may be relevant to explain psychologically how I came to be so bad at arithmetic, but only after you have yourself done the sum and discovered me to be wrong on purely arithmetical grounds. You must find out on purely logical grounds Oh, I'm sorry. In other words, you must show that a man is wrong before you start explaining why he is wrong. Let me say it again, because this is really worth quoting. You must show that a man is wrong before you start explaining why he is wrong. Then he says, the modern method is to assume without discussion that he is wrong and then distract his attention from this, the only real issue, by busily explaining how he became to be, how he came to be so silly. Now, there is a very serious challenge in Christianity that is guilty of this very thing right now. And it's what I call the recycled redeemer notion, that the story about Jesus is simply a recycled story from ancient times of dying and rising redeemers, and all these particulars that we see in the life of Jesus really are just stolen from other stories. Okay, now that's an explanation of how the myth of Jesus came to be, that he stole from other myths. I'm telling you, this particular attack has really upended a lot of Christians. And I have written a piece on this called Recycled Redeemer, and you can find it on our website. But it has really upended a lot of people. Now, there are a whole bunch of problems with this, a whole bunch of factual problems with this premise, but there's a logical problem as well. And I wonder if you caught it when I mentioned the way the argument is put. The myth of Christianity is best explained by ancient myths whose beliefs approximate the beliefs of Christianity and which beliefs Christianity stole from. Does anybody catch it? The myth of Christianity, wait, where'd that come from? What do you mean the myth of Christianity? If you start with the idea that Christianity is a myth, then you can mess around trying to figure out where that myth came from. But first you have to show that a person's wrong before it's meaningful to ask why he is wrong. You see, the problem here is that they never look at the historical accounts themselves and assess them on their merits, which Jim has done for you. They don't assess them on their merits. They just presume it's mythology. Wow, where did this thing come from? Oh, I know. It's just a repetition of the same old thing. But first you have to show that on the merits, these accounts, these primary source historical accounts of the life of Jesus of Nazareth, which we call Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, the principal ones, you have to ask whether these things are reliable or not. Now, if it turns out they're not reliable, then it's meaningful to say, well, where the heck did they come from? But if they are reliable, then we know where they came from. They came from the life of the man of Jesus of Nazareth who actually did these things and said these things. So this whole enterprise of the recycled redeemer is a huge exercise in circular reasoning, which means, and this is another fault, you are assuming your point of view, and then that becomes evidence, essentially, to support your point of view. Maybe I should give you a couple of examples of that. Circular reasoning. Here's an obvious one. The Bible's the Word of God. How do you know that? Well, the Bible says so. God wouldn't lie. And it's the God wouldn't lie part that is the problem. I think the fact that the Bible says so is a good starting point. It's okay. Now you can test that. But you don't assume that it is the Word of God because it says so, and God would lie, because now you're assuming the thing you're trying to prove. You see that? Okay, that would be a very obvious example of circular reasoning. When I was at Marshall University 3 months ago, giving a talk at the university, a person piped up. I think it was a Christian, but he was frustrated because he was thinking about his atheist friends who would respond this way. And he said, you know, my atheist friend, they would just, everything you've told me, this, they would say, this is so preposterous. All this stuff about resurrections and water into wine and all of that stuff, you know, it just sounds like some medieval nonsense that you're bringing back to us today. And I said, well, by the way, if a thing was true in medieval times, it's still true today, all right? So to label it medieval doesn't tell you whether it's true or false, just a way of poisoning the well a little bit. But I said, of course, to an atheist, all of this is going to sound ridiculous if you start from atheism. If you first presume your point of view is true, anything that is outside of the materialistic, naturalistic realm is going to sound ridiculous to your own worldview. So there's a subtle circularity going on there, presuming that your view is correct, and then assessing a competing view in light of your own presumptions about the correctness of your own view. This happened in a debate with Christopher Hitchens and Jay Richards. And Jay was a privileged planet guy, great philosopher, great apologist. In fact, he was one of our speakers on one of our cruises. And in the middle of his presentation, Christopher Hitchens interrupts him and he says, "Do you believe in the resurrection?" And Jay said, "Yes, I do." And Chris Hitchens said, "I rest my case." Now, Hitchens, he's a Peck's bad boy, and he's funny, and he does this kind of stuff, gets laughs and all that. And so he's a little bit hard to deal with because the audience is like that kind of stuff. But when you think about it, what he just did was an exercise in circular reasoning, because he was assuming that anybody who believes in the resurrection, that has to be evidence against their view. But how could it be evidence against their view? It could only be evidence against their view if naturalism was correct. If atheism was correct, which is what the debate was all about. So there's a subtle kind of circularity going on there, and I don't think half the people that were listening caught it. But he got away with it, I actually think, how about this? Capital punishment. Is capital punishment good or bad? I've heard Christians say, look, two wrongs don't make a right. You say, hey, he's got a point. No, he doesn't. That's circular. Two wrongs don't make a right. The question is whether or not capital punishment is right or wrong to begin with. If you say two wrongs don't make a right, you're presuming it's wrong to make your case. So you're arguing in a circle there. Now, here's another thing that comes up a lot. And it's called a straw man. See how much time I got. I'm getting a little short on time. It's called a straw man. A straw man is when you misrepresent another person's view and then you knock down the misrepresentation. Instead of dealing with the man, you build a straw man that's easy to push over, okay? And there are lots and lots of examples of this. This is not good thinking, and it's not good manners. And this is one of the reasons that we ask the question, what do you mean by that? Because we want to make sure we understand the other person's point. We want to get their argument. We want to treat them fairly with regards to their ideas. But this happens all the time. And I'm going to give you some examples of this. The New Atheist's definition of faith is in every instance a straw man. That is, they are claiming something that we hold to be so, which we do not hold to be so. Well, faith, like Richard Dawkins would say, is faith is belief in spite of, even perhaps because of, the lack of evidence. Well, that's not a Christian definition of faith. But it's very easy to destroy a point of view when you characterize it that way, and every single one of the new atheists do this. Every one of them do it. What have they done? They've erected a straw man. Ever hear the seamless garment argument about pro-life view? This is within the pro-life camp. And the point of view is, if you're really pro-life, then you ought to be against capital punishment. If you're not against capital punishment, then you're not really pro-life. Now, if you're a pro-lifer who believes in capital punishment for maybe what you think are good reasons, you're kind of stuck a little bit now, aren't you? You're thinking, well, maybe I... That's the Roman Catholic Church's view right now, by the way. And people will argue that way. We want to be consistently pro-life, so we're against capital punishment. Now, the problem here is that that there is a mischaracterization of pro-lifers' views. Because pro-lifers, I mean, the word pro-life is just kind of a catchword to sum up a point of view, but you can't take the word literally. We are not pro-life. Jains are pro-life, J-A-I-N-S, the Jainist religion. They wear masks so they don't breathe in breathe in microbes. They won't step on an insect. They don't believe in taking any life. They are pro-life in this extended sense. So if you were a Jane and you were pro-life with regards to abortion, you would also be against capital punishment because that's what you mean by pro-life. But that's not what we mean by pro-life. What we mean by pro-life is it's wrong to take the life of an innocent human being in the womb for the reasons that people gave for abortion. But that's kind of a long... You can't make that your position. You got to have a phrase that captures it. But unfortunately, people take advantage of the phrase. They misunderstand it. They misrepresent it. How about this? So have you ever heard this this defense for pro-life view or against abortion? Let me find it. Sometimes we actually commit a straw man fallacy with our own views. You might have heard this before. Would you consider abortion in the following four situations? There's a preacher and wife who are very, very poor. They already have 14 kids. Now she finds out she's pregnant with the 15th. They're living in a tremendous poverty. Considering their poverty and the excessive world population, would you consider recommending she get an abortion? Okay. Then there's actually four examples. I'll read the second one. The father is sick with sniffles. The mother has TB. They have four children. The first is blind. The second is dead. The third is deaf. The fourth has TB. She finds she's pregnant again. Given the extreme situation, would you consider recommending an abortion? Now, this is really meant to play on the contemporary sensibilities about abortion. Oh, yeah, these are the kinds of reasons that people would get abortions. Then they have two more examples that are like that. And then they said... in the first case, if you had aborted your child, you would have killed John Wesley. In the second case, you would have killed Beethoven. And then the third case, you would have killed Ethel Waters, the great black gospel singer. In the fourth case, you would have killed Jesus Christ. Okay, so. Now, this is meant to be making a kind of an argument. And what is the big idea here? What is the point that this illustration is trying to make? What's the big idea? The conclusion, so to speak. No. It's not that hard. Abortion is wrong. That's the point they're trying to make, okay? Why is abortion wrong according to this argument? Because you never know what really great person you might be killing. Now, let me ask you a question. If you're pro-life, is that the pro-life view? Are we against abortion because you never know what kind of life? What if it was Hitler? See, I can work against you. This, I've seen this in lots of different places or something similar to this. This is not our view. Our view isn't that abortion is wrong because it might kill somebody who turns out to be famous or productive or a great scientist or something like that. Whoever, even if it kills Hitler in the womb, it's still wrong. People say, if you don't like abortion, don't have one. To which we could respond, if you don't like slavery, don't own one, right? To kind of give an idea how silly that is. But that actually is a straw man argument. Is our point of view that abortion is wrong because what? We don't like it. Don't like abortion? Don't have one. Is our view that abortion is wrong because we don't like it? That's not our view. Maybe we would like it. Are Christians ever, pro-lifers ever tempted to get an abortion? Yeah. That's not our view. Our view is that it's wrong even if people like it. Okay, so there's a subtle way where someone has mischaracterized a person's view and then made it seem silly in the mischaracterization of it. This one I ran into a couple of days ago, and this is inside our camp. I had a gentleman talking to me about this terrible thing of evolution being taught in Christian churches. Now, he wasn't talking about the surge of theistic evolutionists that there are, and that's a problem. I've written about that, wrote an article called Drifting Towards Darwin. You can find it on our website. He was talking about a person I know with an organization we've worked with, Hugh Ross, and Reasons to Believe. And he mentioned him by name. He said, "You're teaching evolution." I said, "Wait a minute. He's not an evolutionist." And he says to me, "But he believes in an old earth." You do not have any idea how many times I've run across this. Now, I'm not going to fight the battle here about the young earth versus old earth. That's not what I'm concerned about. I'm concerned about the libel that I hear all the time when somebody who believes in an old earth is immediately called an evolutionist, and I have been called that many times because that's my view. Now, I do not believe in the neo-Darwinian synthesis. I argue against it. I write against it. I give talks against it. But I'm not a young earther. This guy says, how could he not be an evolutionist if he's an old earther? And I said, the reason is because believing in an old earth is not the same thing as believing in evolution. They're two separate things. It's a mischaracterization of somebody's view if you call them an evolutionist simply in virtue of believing in an old earth. There are theistic evolutionists who believe in an old earth and the Darwinian project. Okay? But that's not what I'm talking about here. I'm talking about people who are kind of in the middle on this. They believe in intelligent design and creation, and they reject and fight vigorously against the Darwinian project, but they believe in an old earth. For them to be called evolutionists time and time again by their own brothers and sisters in Christ is just a stinking shame, as far as I'm concerned. It is shameful to do that. Now, again, they may be wrong on their old earth view, okay? And maybe the young earthers are right. But the young earthers who make this point are not right in calling them evolutionists simply in virtue of that. Now, these are all examples of ways arguments go bad in silly ways. This is all examples of clearing the brush. And I got a lot more examples of that. We're just running out of time here. I just want to end with one other thing, though, that it's another kind of fallacy, and it's called complex question. And you don't need to, again, remember the names of these things, but I hope you remember the concept. Complex question is when a question is asked, and the answer, in answering the question, you are forced by the way the question is asked to answer two questions at once because there's a hidden question that's in the original question. The simplest way is to give me for me to do this is just to give you an example. Are you still beating your wife? Okay. If you say yes, you're saying you do beat your wife and you're still doing it. If you say no, you're saying you used to beat your wife and you're not doing it anymore. But in each case, either a yes or no answer still commits you to something that you don't mean to commit yourself to. That's because of the way the question is asked, okay? Now, this is an example. There's a popular example of this in the discussion about God. And I got asked this question when I debated against Michael Shermer. Michael Shermer said, okay, who created God? It's a complex question. What is he assuming when he says, who created God? God was created. Now, a lot of Christians get stumped on this. They don't know how to answer it, but they don't realize that this is a trick. It assumes that God was created, and now you got to tell him who it was. At least that's the way the question is asked. And so I was ready. I knew he was going to ask this question, so I was ready. And here's what I said. I said, Michael, you don't believe God was created because you don't believe in God. I don't believe God was created because I think God is eternal. Nobody in this discussion believes God was created, so why are you asking who created God? So it's kind of a little trick way, rhetorically tricky way to get to the issue and help to show the audience that, you know, this is a red herring. It just takes us off the topic. Self-existent being needs no creator. And I know Richard Dawkins says, well, if the world is complex and it needs a designer, then who designed the designer? Because the designer who designed the complex world must be much more complex than the world he designed. Okay, a couple of things wrong with that. First of all, notice that he never answers the challenge. He shifts the argument. Does the universe look designed, or at least the biological realm? He says yes. It's the first line of his book, of The Blind Watchmaker. The biological realm is a complex world that gives the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. So he acknowledges that. Okay, but then he uses the blind watchmaker of evolution to do the job. But when he makes this kind of challenge, he never really answers the charge. He just shifts it to us and say, well, who designed the designer? Look, you don't need to know who designed the design thing to know that the thing itself was designed. All right? You go down to the beach and you see a set of footprints and you say, hey, wow, looks like somebody's been here before us. We thought we got out early. They got out earlier, and they're in the wet sand of the footprints. And you say, no, wait. You think somebody made those? Who was he? The same question, right? Who designed the designer? You don't need to know who did it or who made the shoes to know that those are footprints. It's just a distraction, and the discussion is full of them. Well, our time is out, and This last session was a little haphazard. We were jumping over with a lot of different things, but I hope you got a couple of basic things in your mind. When you want to do assessment, you want to ask yourself the bigger question, what is the argument, okay? And you start with the big idea. What are they trying to convince you of? And then you look at the reasons they give in favor of what they're trying to convince you of, and you attach them by the word, therefore, and you ask if it works. You make sure that the facts are straight. Make sure that the terms are clear and not vague. And then you beware of all of this stuff that people throw in the way to get you confused, all these red herrings that people use to pull you off the track. And if you can do that, the more you do that, the more you're going to be able to see the nonsense, the easier it's going to be to work through these issues. Once you see the problems, then you can use your tactical approach to exploit the problems you now see by using what? Questions. By using questions to exploit the problems. Just like I did with Michael Shermer. Then why are you asking who created God? All right.